west, Dante set himself to the earthen ramparts the Noran were piling behind the stone wall. At his command, dirt flowed uphill, forming loose mounds the warriors tamped down with shovels and their own feet. In the scheme of things, his efforts weren't much. By the time his strength gave out, he'd added some 10 feet to the left wing of the rampart, raising that stretch just above his head. But it helped. And he was there as much for the practice at earth-moving as for the aid he could give to the fortification. As with all things, skill could only come through effort. The effort and its immediate results left him flushed with wonder and hope. Callie's loon remained blank, however. Ravenous, he paused for dinner, then went to find Blaze and explain what he could do. Blaze nodded slowly. "So you can move dirt from one place to another, can you?" Dante snapped his fingers. "Like that." "That's going to come in very handy if we're attacked by a wild pack of sandcastles. Look, this is just a start. In time, I may be able to form whole ramparts overnight." Blaze jerked his thumb at the Noran toiling on the earth wall despite the twilight. "Looks like they've tapped into the same magic." Instead of speaking, Dante sought the ground-up bones and powdered skin embedded in the dirt beneath Blaze's feet, then yanked it 6 inches to the left. Blaze fell straight on his ass. "Make more sense now," Dante said. Blaze hopped up, smacking dirt from his pants. "All that proves is I'm drunk."
"Are you?"
"What, you aren't? We're going to be attacked tomorrow."
"You're right.
I have the sudden urge to start drinking until I can't stand up. Think they'll kill a man with a hangover?" Blaze waved a hand through the darkening air.
"Quit bitching and start thinking. You may have forgotten this, what with your fancy loons that let you talk to someone hundreds of miles away, but that army doesn't know a thing about what happened here. As far as they know, this fort is still manned by 200 of the king's finest."
Dante folded his arms and considered the ground.
"There's a chance, however small, they'll reappraise the situation when they see the walls are manned by a horde of bearded giants.
So, don't let them see that."
"Sorry, I still don't know how to stop the sun from rising. I'll see if I can work that one out before bedtime."
"It's a lot simpler than that, dummy. We've got 3 humans here, and we can stick a lot more on the walls."
Dante gaped. "Those bodies down there look like overcooked stew. We can't just prop them on the merlins and expect the enemy to wave hello."
"Lyle's balls, do I have to do everything?" Blaze said. "Conjure up some of those visions of yours. A score of red-shirted soldiers watching impassively from the battlements. Lure a bunch of the king's men into town. Then seal up the gates with a big plug of dirt to cut the rest of them off. The Noran behind the walls get to go all choppy on the troops inside, while the warriors on the wall go all shooty on the red shirts trapped outside."
"That," Dante said, "is not a bad idea."
"Of course it's not. It's a great idea. If I were paid by the idea, I could retire off that one. That's how great that idea is."
"I'm going to talk to the chiefs."
Dante glanced around the grounds. "Meanwhile, I've got a much more important mission for you."
Blaze straightened.
"What's that?"
"Fetch us the celebratory rum."
Blaze nodded solemnly and ran away.
Dante found Hop speaking with Morn inside the foyer of one of the round earthen homes. He laid out the plan. Hop chuckled, grinning his foxy grin, and raised his brown brows at Morn.
"What do you think?"
Morn stiffened. "I'm not a strategist, unless speaking unlearnedly about strategy makes me one, but I have no formal training in strategy."
"You think I do? Strategy's about guts and intuition.
You're a chieftain now. Don't you want to act like one?" "I would argue that chieftaincy is not defined by the role itself, but rather by the individuals who fill that role."
Morn gave Dante a dubious look.
But it sounds like a pretty good plan.
We could just post the real-life Norrin along the wall, Dante said, convince the Redshirts this isn't the hill they want to die on.
Harp shook his head sharply. We're going to have to kill an awful lot of them before we can convince the rest to go home. Don't you think we're better off behind these walls than meeting them in the field?
Dante had no rebuttal for that. In the streets, Norrin worked by torchlight to carve arrow shafts and fletch them with the feathers of the villagers' geese and turkeys and chickens. Dante returned to the house he'd been quartered in. The clank of the smith's hammers woke him more than once. In the morning, the gates were back up and ready to be closed, though a soft-spoken smith, whose nolla was clearly ironwork, assured him the new hinges were ill-fitting and brittle, prone to breakage under any serious assault. Too starved to think straight, Dante thanked him and headed out for a breakfast of chicken and bread. The scouts returned while he was still belching. Garsk's army was on the move. At rough count, it bore 1,000 footmen and some 80 cavalry. Half again what the depleted clans could muster. Good odds, regardless, if one were behind strong gates and not battle-worn from a previous engagement. Less so when the day's plan involved letting scores of the enemy walk straight through the gates. Dante climbed to the turret on the left side of the mended doors to watch the green valley and the opposite ridge. Behind him, warriors scooped away the rampart immediately behind the gates to hide it from the enemy until the Redshirts had already passed into the killing zone. Norrin lugged sheafs of arrows up to the walls and distributed them at intervals. Just before noon, 10 riders crested the far hill. Dante hurried to put on a uniform claimed from one of the dead bodies. It had been scrubbed and restitched, but it still smelled like blood, and worse. The gates closed with a boom. A stern call silenced the work of hammers and axes and chisels and shovels. Blazon's Lyra, the other two real humans participating in the farce, ran up to the battlements, kissed and spread out along the wall. Dante waited for the riders to start up the base of the wedge to Borrel, then summoned the images of several more guards. At first, these were nothing more than fuzzy silhouettes, shadow figures that took none of his strength to maintain but looked perfectly real from a half mile away. As the riders grew near, he filled the figures in with increasing layers of detail until you'd have to be standing right next to them to see they weren't breathing. The riders pulled up 10 yards from the gate. A lean-muscled man with a thick black beard shucked off his helmet and squinted up at Dante.
"Hail and such!
To you, too," Dante said, doing his best to neutralize his Malish Narashtovic accent. The rider gazed across the battle-churned field and boot-stomped sod.
"All's well? Had an attack a couple nights back. One of the tribes, the big one, puts them down easily enough."
"Typical," the man laughed humorlessly.
"Well, the rest of us are just that way. Be seeing you in a couple hours."
Dante nodded, heart bumping. The rider turned his horse and headed down the dirt path. The others followed. As the men hit the valley, Dante prayed to Aron they wouldn't circle around the butte and find the pile of bodies bloating between the rocks. But the mounted scouts continued straight back the way they came. Dante dispelled the shadow figures. The men crossed beyond the hill. He signaled to Stan. Stan tipped back his head and let out a long, upward-lilting note. The Norrin burst from the houses, jogging to positions along the wall. Others continued to make last-minute additions to the wooden palisade and the earthworks supporting them. Men carried up water and food to those on the walls. The sun inched along the sky. Less than 2 hours later, the far hill turned black with men. Scores of horsemen, hundreds of footmen, a flock of ox-driven wagons that slowed their progress to a casual walk. Dante sweated in his false clothes.
he returned his silhouettes to the battlements and probed at the dirt in the tunnel beneath the gates. It, too, was freshly blood-soaked, thick with death and nether, ready to respond. Warriors flattened themselves behind the merlins. Dante sharpened the lines of his illusory guards. The army rumbled down the hill and started up the butte. Dante's nerves thrummed. Impossibly, the king's men continued on, oblivious to the counter-army lurking among the fortifications. The human soldiers carried unstrung bows and unsheathed swords, shoving each other, joking, faces grimy with the sweat and dirt of a long march through hostile lands. And then they stood before the gates, a blanket of troops smothering the grasses. Horses snorted. The smell of their sweat climbed the walls. Dante straightened atop his tower, raising a hand to the rider who pranced forward, his lightweight red cape snapping behind him.
"General Varamord, Earl of Jutland," he called in the crisp and regal accent of his homeland, a rich farming country bordering Setevan itself. "I request entry for the King's Army of the Vartan Forest and surrounding lands."
Dante saluted and barked a command down to the gates. Wood and hinges creaked. The Earl of Jutland faced his troops and hollered them forward with the elegant nonsense of martial commands shouted loudly enough for an army to hear. Dante fought down a giggle and the urge to vomit. Were they really letting an enemy army stroll through their front door? The first troops emerged on the far side of the wall, a mixture of cavalry and their aides. Infantry with spears and swords and studded armor followed them through. Varamord frowned at the empty grounds, the fresh ramparts, the burnt and disassembled husks of houses.
"What has happened here?"
Hop screamed like it was the end of the world. Scores of Norren popped up from behind walls of wood and stone, unleashing a punishing volley of arrows. Men screamed among the twang of bows. Varamord whipped out his sword.
"To arms! Treachery! To arms!"
Confusion rippled through the men outside the gates. They reached for bows and swords. Inside, the surviving soldiers fumbled out swords and spears and charged the palisaded archers. With a great cry, the men outside the walls surged into the tunnel. Time to cut them off, to plug the gates and slaughter those trapped inside. Dante dispersed his shadow figures with a wave and plunged his focus into the dirt beneath the red shirt's trampling feet. The nether waited. He grabbed hold and yanked. But the dirt held firm.
Chapter 21 Dante froze. Soldiers rushed through the open gates and into the storm of arrows and blades raging around the ramparts. Varamord jolted from his mount, an arrow sticking from his hip. His cavalry screamed in anger and galloped behind the palisades, swords glinting in the sun. Again, Dante grasped the nether in the soil between the gates. Had he pulled too hard the first time? Like whipping a tablecloth out from under a set of dishes without spilling a one? Or had his entire control of the earth been a fluke, only to falter when his failure might mean the death of everyone here? He pulled again. Again the nether moved, but the dirt between its shadowy strands stayed put. His head went dizzy. He forced himself to slow his breathing to a steady tide. He saw it at once. Knife-like, he had honed in on the nether itself. He needed to relax, to move not just the nether, but all it was bound to. Like that, he could feel the weight of the dirt, the solid strength of the pebbles and stones. He yanked on the dark net a third time. A great rumble boomed from below. Men shouted in alarm. Dante sucked in the dirt like an outgoing wave and mounded it to the top of the tunnel. A half-dozen soldiers were swept up in the rush, instantly crushed beneath a tide of dirt. The flow of men into the village stopped cold.
On the other side of the plug, swords whacked into the earthen wall as if the locked-out soldiers could simply chop their way through. The Norren on the walls poured fire into the shattered ranks trapped inside the fort. At the base of the steps, Blaze and Lyra fought side by side, falling back under a throng of red shirts hopping to push up the steps and carve into the archers crouched behind the walls. Dante ran forward, slinging a bolt of nether through the neck of the foremost soldier. He fell in a red spray. The man behind him stumbled. Blaze jabbed forward, impaling the man on his own momentum. The man's dying weight forced him back, unbalancing him against the steps and exposing his lead leg to an incoming sword. Lyra knocked it aside with a backhand sweep and grabbed the attacker's wrist with her bare hand. The man pulled back on his arm. Lyra flowed after him, keeping clamped on his wrist while her elbow bent and slammed into his face. His sword clanged on the steps. She buried her sword in his belly. Dante struck out again, aiming for another neck, but his hold on the nether was wobbly, weakening. The lance of arrows clipped the man's collarbone. He shrieked, flailing at the enemy who wasn't there. Blaze stabbed him in his turned back and kicked him down the stairs. The crowd at the steps had been reduced to a couple. Something similar had happened along the ramparts, where the cavalry had cut their way through the Norren lines before succumbing to spears and arrows. Horses thrashed in the dirt, trying to rise and flopping to their bellies. Scattered red shirts fought on, falling swiftly beneath the hammer blows of the Norren's outsized weapons. A group of four of the king's men cut down a pair of warriors from a clan Dante didn't recognize. A band of Norren rushed them, howling, and the four soldiers bolted toward the stone houses across the field. Cut off from the rest of their troop, with all their officers dying or dead, the few survivors flung down their weapons and raised their hands. The Norren on the walls swiveled to the opposite side and fired down on the men still trying to dig through the damned gate. In less than a minute, the survivors outside broke, fleeing downhill in a mad run, arrows whisking between them, felling them into the hot grass. They abandoned the wagons and the wounded. A knot of men remained trapped under the gates, unwilling to risk a run. Instead, the archers climbed down inside the walls to set up behind the arrow slits. The red shirt's screams filtered up the wall where Dante sat to catch his breath. Like that, it was over. All that was left was to tend to the wounded. Death for the kingsmen, who were cut down and dragged to the cliff's edge. Their own warriors were carried on shoulders and stretchers to the great hall above, which Orlin had killed the commander, and Morn had killed Orlin. Warriors set to work digging out the gates. A handful leapt down from the walls into the grass to chase down the oxen and bring the wagons up to the village. When Dante called, the Nether hesitated, sapped by his struggles with the earth. But he left to the hall to do what little he could for the wounded. Inside the hall, he could hear the screams from the cliffs. This wasn't war with all the niceties between squabbling kings. It had passed beyond that. In mere days it had become something twisted and vicious. The Norren fought the way a wounded lion fought, half mad and pitiless. Any humans who came to the Norren territories to hurt the Norren would never go home again. Dante washed his hands of blood and returned to the hard yellow sunlight. Warriors milled everywhere, washing up, hauling the barrels and sacks from the captured wagons into a pair of the houses built into the ground. Others dug a mass grave for their own dead. Their apparent lack of regard for the departed was curious, almost disturbing. There was nothing organized about it. Some cried while others dug. When the hole was deep enough, they filled it with bodies, then walked away. There were no public words, no tombstones or eulogies. Within minutes, the fallen returned to the hills that had birthed them. Was this, too, the product of their nomadic lives? Why leave a gravestone when you might never return? Was it one more sign of their stoicism? and why did it bother him? It somehow seemed more final, as if the dead were already long gone and soon forgotten. He hadn't been with them long enough to understand. Hop again came through without a scratch. He grinned at the torn-up ramparts, but his eyes were pained.
"Cut it a little closer there with the gates, didn't you?"
"Considering I just learned how to do that yesterday, I'd say I did pretty good."
"We are alive. It could have been worse."
Dante nodded at the blood-soaked wall of raw dirt.
"How many losses?"
50. 60.
Hop's grin soured.
"Do they always have so many horses?"
"The rich ones do.
Fortunately for us, there are always more poor." "Well, I don't like them. The horses. Or the men who ride them.
What can we do about them?"
"Spears help," Dante said. "If you can figure out something more effective than that, we'll never lose another battle."
Dante had felt oddly detached from the victory. Moody, unenthused. The talk with Hop helped a little. So did the contents of one of the wagons, casks of beer and rum, which the Norren quickly distributed throughout the yurts and houses of the village. Others hauled broken chunks of the palisades and piled them into crackling bonfires, not because there was any need for warmth, but because lighting huge fires was simply what one did after a big victory. Some sang songs, minor keyed and angrily joyous. A pair of broken herons slung Dante up on their bumping shoulders and hauled him to a spot beside the fire. A mug was sloshed into his hands. The undiluted rum brought tears to his eyes. The wet wood threw thick white smoke into the sky. Strangers joined the circle around the fire to ask his name and give theirs. He found himself laughing. When they urged him to tell them what he'd done to make the earth rise, he told them of his first two failures and how he thought they might all die because he'd promised the impossible. And they laughed, too. He was far from sober when Blaze found him. Blaze's grin was crooked and devilish, and at first Dante assumed he'd been off in the bedroom with Lyra somewhere. And maybe he had, but he also bore something far more interesting. General Varamord's marching orders. Dante stood, open-mouthed, and extricated himself from the celebrants at the fire. Inside the stone house where he was quartered, he sat down in the lamplight with the leather-wrapped bundle of papers. The orders were more or less as Stan surmised. Varamord had been charged with taking command of the fort at Borrel and operating as the backbone of Gascon military operations in the region, checkmating any major threats, should they appear, while smaller divisions were dispatched to the front to take the towns beyond the border, one by one. There were no contingency orders for what to do if the fort was lost. It simply hadn't been planned for. Furthermore, no legions larger than a couple hundred men were expected to arrive in the territories within the next 4 weeks. Everything had hinged on Varamord's campaign at the fort. Dante sat back and rubbed his hand over his mouth. "It'll be days before the survivors make it back across the border. Days after that until they get word to anyone who can make a decision about what to do next. Even if they push up their schedule, we have 2 weeks or more before they can count on another threat against the territories."
"I'm sensing something fiendish," Blaze said.
"Well, shouldn't we?"
"Of course. We can't let the Norren in the border town sit there in chains, when we could be stomping red-shirt ass so hard the king tries to outlaw boots."
Dante rolled his lip between his teeth.
"Would still be risky.
If we get knocked out trying to retake the towns, the territories will be back to defending themselves with scattered clans."
"We can't not take that risk."
Blaze stood up to prowl around the table.
"All the mucking around we've done down here, that boils down to a pledge to the Norren to protect them, to keep them out of trouble.
If we've got Norren cities occupied by Gascon troops, we're honor-bound to liberate them.
Dante set down the papers and peered at Blaze.
Honor-bound? You've been spending too much time with Lyra. Well, it's true, isn't it? We made a bond to better their lives. If we don't keep that bond, we've betrayed them.
Maybe the best way to better their lives is to consolidate what we've got before we go dashing about with banners in hand.
What's this? You were the one who brought up striking back.
And then your reasons for agreeing were so dumb I reversed my mind.
Blaze snorted. It's a smart play either way you look at it. Our whole philosophy is to press every advantage we get, isn't it? Well, we've got an army of angry giants. I'd say that trumps their nothing of nothing.
I'm going to get hold of Callie, Dante said. Then we'll see what Hop and the chieftains have to say.
To Dante's mild surprise, Callie answered in an instant.
I hear a certain someone convinced a certain substance to flow in ways that substance never should.
It turns out you don't move the earth, Dante said. You move the nether and the earth moves with it.
That doesn't make any sense. You always move the nether. If what you say is true, I'd be knocking down walls and tearing down ceilings every time I summoned it.
You have to kind of relax when you do it. Go slow, but strong, like pushing a bookshelf across the room. If you push too fast, the whole thing topples over.
I see, Callie said. My suggestion to you, never try teaching.
If I could show you, it would make a lot more sense.
Next time you're back in Narashtavik, then.
In the meantime, we've got a conundrum, Dante said.
As far as we can tell, we just smashed the enemy's only major force in the region.
So, counterattack.
Cheers thundered from outside. Dante glanced out the window.
What, just like that?
Is there a better time to counterattack than when the enemy has nothing to counter-counterattack with?
Sure, when he's got nothing and he's drunk in bed.
Modigan and his viziers thought conquering the Norren would be like plucking bearded cave-dwelling flowers, Callie said. You just broke their advanced legion. What if you can kick them out of the territories entirely? Would they sign a peace treaty then?
You think so?
Aran's bowels no.
The old man chuckled.
But you never know.
Dante clicked off and wandered outside. Drums beat steadily, as low and monotonous as a heartbeat. Norren moved about the fires in what some might call a dance. To Dante it looked more like sparring. Warriors crouched low, lashing out with straight kicks their partners intercepted with kicks of their own. In unpredictable rhythms, they pivoted on their heels, lurching in to deliver slaps to their partners' faces and chests. The snapping fires cast long, swift shadows over the battle-torn grass. Dante found Hop smiling wickedly on the perimeter.
Didn't get enough fighting during the day? Dante said.
You've never seen our dance of conquering before.
Why would I have? I've only been warring alongside your people for months now. You're normally so open with outsiders.
You wouldn't have had the chance, Hop said. You don't see this before any old skirmish. This dance is reserved for the big invasion of enemy lands.
Dante tried to read Hop's face, but his head was clouded by the headache of departing liquor.
Invasion?
We've decided we don't like seeing any of our cousins in chains.
The fire washed Hop's branded face in white and red.
We're going to take our lands back.
It didn't wind up as much of a fight. Two more clans came to Burrell the next day. The chiefs left a token force to hold the fort, while the main army headed south at a jog. They hit the river 3 days later. The first village they reached was defended by fewer than 20 redshirts crowded into a single house. The Norren shot them down as they fled out the back door, arrows sprouting from the redshirts' backs like sudden weeds. It was over
in minutes. After Norrin wandered from their hillside houses, gazing on the dead soldiers with secret smiles, before rushing to embrace the sweating clansmen who'd set them free. A handful of villagers joined them as they camped outside town. Another clan met them in the fields the next day. They captured a second village that morning, and a third by afternoon. The Gascon troops in both were token forces that might not have been able to withstand a single clan. If General Varamord's army had been in place at Borrel, with roving legions sweeping away any clans that poked up their heads, the village garrisons may have been able to keep their Norrin charges in check. Before the combined army of the clans, they were snuffed out like embers that had strayed too far from the fire. At Kling, the garrison of 60 human soldiers had dug a hasty trench across the switchback path up the cliffs, fortified on the trench's downhill side by a fence of sharpened sticks. From their perch, they fired down on the plaza, arrows peppering the clan warriors and plinking off the mosaic of the salmon. A frontal attack would be as bloody as a birth. Instead, Hop pulled Dante aside, then embedded the bulk of the troops in the shops around the plaza. As they took shelter, Hop led Dante and two clans worth of warriors up into the hills west of town. 2 hours later, they emerged on the upper end of the cliffside roads. Below them, on the switchback, the red shirts shifted their ranks to point their spears uphill. Just four men, shoulder to shoulder, could block the road completely. With 15 ranks of the king's men, clearing them out would cost dearly. Instead, Dante sat on his heels and followed the death into the ground beneath them. He found it and pulled. It was a clumsy job, less powerful by half than what he intended. An 8-foot section of cliffside road, that seamless road laid down by a Norrin master, a road that would have stood for 1,000 years, cracked away from the slope, crumbling downhill in a deadly rain that swept 12 men down with it. The others leapt away from the avalanche with panicked shouts. Hop hollered, and the Norrin pincered the human defenders from above and below. Bodies splashed into the plaza below. It was over in minutes. A chunk of the docks and riverside houses had been burnt to the foundations. Most of the remaining houses were empty of Norrin and humans alike. The few residents they found told them both peoples had been taken inland, deeper into Gask, the humans presumably as refugees, the Norrin as slaves. Not all had been taken. A few remained as servants to the soldiers. Others were prisoners, locked into a cave carved into the base of the cliffs. That was where they found Banning, the lanky grey-bearded mayor, chained in total darkness to a rough stone wall. Dante's torch stone lit the way. Banning raised his shaggy head.
One of his eyes had been put out, the socket crusty with blood and pus.
His lean face had become skeletal, stretched over his broad cheekbones until his nose stood out like a lonely mountain. The fingers of his right hand were crushed, mangled. The room smelled like urine and sickness. Recognition gleamed in Banning's remaining eye.
"You again."
"Quit talking." Dante knelt next to him. He could feel the old man's heat before he touched his pale skin. Infection raged in his veins. His gums were white. He grabbed Dante's arm, chains clanking, but his Norrin strength had become childlike.
"My painting."
Dante called forth the nether. "Now's not the time for that."
"Now's the only time."
His shout broke into a hoarse croak.
"Get me my painting, you baby-legged son of a bitch!"
"What's the matter with you?" Blaze said. "We're here to help."
"My painting. The girl by the river. The paints, too. Remember where my workshop is?"
"Yeah, off in the woods with Gorge.
Then quit gaping at me and go get my goddamned painting.
Panning slumped against the cool wall and closed his eye. Blaze pressed his lips together, ready to object, then ran out of the cavern. Dante stayed with Panning, but the Nether couldn't bring back the old mare's eye or untwist his fingers. For all Dante's efforts, it couldn't fight off the fever either. Panning's chest fell in shallow jerks. Sometimes he drifted off, head snapping upright whenever his chin fell too far. As Dante soothed his pain, two warriors braced Panning's chains, set a metal wedge against them, and struck them off with blows from a sledge. The iron bracelets dangled from the man's wrists. He let his hands rest on the grimy rock floor and closed his eye. Feet pounded down the dim hall. Panning's eye whipped open. Blaze hustled inside with a canvas on an easel and a rattling kit. Panning tried to lean forward and slumped back against the wall. As the old man swore, Blaze set down the kit and cracked it open. Bottles of paint sat in jostled racks, stoppers crusted with reds and blues and greens. He placed the easel in front of Panning and stepped back.
All better, Blaze said. I should have go fetch your smock, too.
Panning grinned up at him.
Don't think I won't stand up and slug you.
Dante helped him lean forward. Panning's skin burned. He had the sour, uric smell of something that hasn't moved in too long. His unbroken left hand trembled as he reached for his brushes and paints. To Dante, the canvas looked nearly complete, a portrait of a young Norrin woman beside a grey river, her smile as light as the waters were dark. Spidery trees hung over the banks, threatening to snag the girl's hair and shoulders. But a glowing halo held them at bay from her head. The image was so vivid, Dante could almost hear her laugh. Panning dabbed the brush into a pot of grey. His hand shook, flicking tiny driblets of paint. Sweat slimed his brow. Teeth gritted. He steadied first his breathing, then his hand. He touched the brush to the canvas. That first touch was like the touch of a torch to dry hay. Panning's remaining strength coalesced into his hand, swooping and dabbing and flicking across the canvas. He croaked commands without looking from his work. Dante handed him rags and paint and brushes and a jar of cleaning water. 10 minutes later, he signed his name in black on the corner of the canvas and wilted against the wall. His sweat had dried long ago. With a plunging stomach, Dante realized the aged mare had simply run out of sweat. He was out of water, out of strength.
"Granddaughter in Dolandun," Panning whispered. "Cora."
He nodded at the pretty young girl in the painting, then leaned his head back against the wall, eyes squeezed tight.
"That's her. Can you give her this?"
"Of course," Dante said. He blinked at the painting of the bright young girl, warded from the darkness of the world. He never knew if Panning heard. When he turned, the old man's face had gone slack and smooth, his pain forgotten. Dante pushed the man's shackle up his wrist. He felt no pulse. One of the warriors had to turn away. Blaze rubbed his mouth with the back of his hand. "I'll stay here until the painting dries. Her name was Cora." Dante nodded. He helped the warriors bring the body up from the cave. It was shockingly light, as limp as worn-out clothes. While they buried the town's dead Norrin together atop the cliffs, other warriors dragged the dead red shirts to the piers and pitched them into the river to feed the fish. They stayed in Kling for 3 days, waiting on wagons of grain from Tatonen.
Warriors foraged and scattered the woods. One new clan joined them each day, swelling their army to more than 1,000. Once the wagons arrived, Hop led them northwest along the river that marked the border between the Norrin territories and Old Gask. Blaze took the painting with him. The next three villages were emptied of redshirts. Word had spread. At the fourth, the heavy corpses of Norrin lay in the streets. The only sounds and motion were the buzzing of flies, the guilty trot of dogs fleeing the gnawed bodies. At the next bridge, Morn split the Nine Pines away from the army to hunt down the killers, taking his loon with him. "Promise you won't fight unless you can win," Dante told him. Morn watched the wind blow the trees.
"No."
"What do you mean, no? How is you dying going to help us?"
"The Nine Pines will die when we choose to die."
Dante frowned. "Taking to your new role, after all?"
"I may not want it. In fact, there is no may. I don't want it. I would rather be asleep in a field somewhere, or alive in another time. But this is what my clan wants of me."
"I just meant it was fast. If you won't promise that, at least promise me you'll choose your last words in advance. Otherwise, when the moment comes, you might say something stupid, and we'll have to pretend we never knew you."
Morn grinned sheepishly. The old Morn again, if only for a moment. "I promise. Unless I drop dead before tonight. I think best at night."
They clasped hands. Morn joined his warriors. The Nine Pines strode across the bridge with their bows and swords. As soon as the body of the army made camp, Dante's loon pulsed. Across the long miles, Callie giggled.
"Got a surprise for you tomorrow."
"A good surprise," Dante said, "or a Callie surprise."
"I said it was a surprise. By definition, if I were to tell you what it was, it would not be a surprise, contradicting my original statement with a paradox we might never unravel."
"Best to leave the universe intact, then, and leave it a surprise."
"Whatever it is, it appears to have driven you insane."
"Only time will tell, my boy. Now get some sleep. You never know what the morrow brings."
"Best to be well rested for it."
After that, Dante had no idea what to expect. Callie in the flesh, perhaps. A cask of flounders, fresh from Narashtavik's North Bay. A fine set of ponies. The next afternoon, two scouts came back at a run to speak to Hop and Stan. As the army marched on, the river bent left. Around a rocky spur, the land flattened, revealing a great host of men. The warriors laughed, jogging through the flat plain to meet their far-flung cousins. Hart and Somber were there too, dressed in the black and silver of Narashtavik, the silver brooch of Bardon clasping their cloaks around their necks. Hart looked younger than Dante'd ever seen the wizened Norrin councilman.
"We brought you something," Hart said.
"Looks more like 1,000-somethings," Blay said.
"About 1,200, last count. I think we picked up a few more along the way."
Dante gazed in shock at the mingling warriors.
"From the eastern reaches?"
"Mostly the northern grasslands."
Hart smoothed his robe over his paunch.
"We'd heard you were doing well enough for yourselves here in the west."
"Better than I feared," Dante said. "It's good to see you. I think I need to speak to my chief now."
Blaze fell in step as Dante tried to spy Hop among the towering crowds of Norrin.
"This is an awful lot of warriors."
Dante shook his head.
"I'd say it's leapt from an awful lot to a hell of a lot."
"You know what hells are good for? Unleashing."
"But who is sinful enough to deserve such unleashing?"
"First off, let's exclude ourselves from consideration. With that out of the way, King Modigan would top my list, but like all good kings, he's whacking off in a tower while his soldiers get gutted. Next, I would suggest Cassander on grounds of general bastardliness, but I have no clue where he is. Blaze took a breath. At this point, I'm out of ideas, and I'm getting frustrated, so I'm going to suggest we just go burn the shit out of Dolandon and see what happens next.
That's what I was thinking.
Dante jerked his chin at the mountains due west, behind which lurked the northernmost lake of Galador.
If we take Dolandon, the lakelands are the only major route into the territories. Even if the merchants let the king's men through, they'll be delayed by days.
Sure, it makes strategical sense, too. I was more interested in just really pissing them off.
Hop was keeping his usual remove from the boisterous union of men and women, many of whom were distant relations of one sort or another. He gave Dante and Blaze a nod.
Quite a troop, don't you think?
On a completely unrelated note, Blaze said, how far is Dolandon from here?
Hop's mouth bent in a wry smile.
Think we'd have enough?
Only one way to find out.
We'll send the scouts tonight.
Hop rubbed his thick forearm.
Still a lot of Norrin on the eastern shore of the city, I hear. Wonder if they're happy about the king's troops keeping them locked in their homes.
He conferred with the other chiefs, while the two wings of warriors continued to integrate, passing news from their homelands and tracing family lines until they found common relatives. It didn't take long for the chieftains to reach a consensus. They'd bivouac behind the bend in the river, while the scouts snuck into Dolandon. Equipped with loons, they'd report their findings, at which point the army would make its next move. Blaze asked Hop to tell the scouts to be on the lookout for a young girl named Cora. The night was one of songs and drinks and fires. Dante couldn't have slept if he'd wanted to. The cheers and group holler-alongs didn't die down until 2 in the morning. They resumed, if somewhat less vigorously, by 8 in the morning, propelled by the standard group sleeping dynamic. At night, no one gets to sleep before everyone's ready to sleep. In the morning, everyone's woken as soon as the first 2 people get up and start talking. While the warriors were more than friendly, several of the new arrivals plumbed Dante for stories about the battles at Cassander's Manor, and more recently those at Burrell, he found himself feeling isolated, pensive, and restless. At a lull in the early afternoon, he excused himself to the latrine and wandered into the woods. For the rest of the daylight, he practiced moving the earth. Nothing major. The equivalent of a shovel load at a time. Any more and his control tended to slip, the nether slicing through the rich brown dirt as quickly as if the soil weren't there at all. When it came to a handful of soil, however, he could move that as reliably and precisely as his own foot. He set his dogged mind to understanding each step of the process before allowing himself to move on. He couldn't say how much progress he'd made by the time Morn looned him, 2 days later, to tell him the 9 Pines had killed the killers and were on their way back to Norrin lands. Dante told him to hurry, which turned out to be wise. The scouts reported in that same day. Dolandon was manned by several 100 redshirts. Hard to say how many, given that they were distributed among 5 or 6 different barracks, towers, and walls, but at least 800. Perhaps twice that many. The Norrin outnumbered them, in other words, but not great odds when it came to the capture of a city. Hop invited Dante to the War Council as his advisor of human affairs. Stan recounted the details with his typical slavish attention to numbers.
Risky, he concluded. Lots of troops in a city full of human citizens who could readily become troops— Cities aren't good things to attack.
A chieftain named Tenor shook her head, braids brushing her shoulders.
Everything is a good thing to attack if it is attacked in the way that is right to that thing.
Stan gave her a peevish look.
If you know of the right way to attack a city, I have 2 ears for you.
I don't agree that Dolandon is a city.
No. Hop smiled.
Then, is it a very coincidental proximity of houses?
I think it is two cities, Tenna said. One Norrin, one human. Only one of these is hostile to us.
That's the spooked hare, isn't it? Stan said. Don't know which way it'll break.
Hop lifted his brows.
Let me ask you this. Will we ever have a better chance of taking it?
Stan exhaled noisily.
Not unless we find a way to become potato people who can budge new warriors as we please. The question is whether we need to take it.
The council went silent in that particular Norrin way that meant everything relevant had already been said. Hop clapped his hands.
Next question, then. Do we attack by day or by night?
Dante's grin was as wild as the hills. Reluctantly, Stan helped bash out the strategy. Get the scouts to alert the Norrin still in Dolendon to prepare, march to within 10 miles, sleep through the first half of the night, and resume movement at midnight to catch the city at dawn. Meet up with the Dolendon Norrin rebels, who would act as guides and auxiliary report as the army branched out to strike as many of the Red Shirts' fortifications as possible before the king's garrison could retreat to a single defense. After that, the clans would reconvene and launch an assault on whatever was left.
It sounded good. It sounded better than waiting for the king to muster an army that the Norrin could never match.
The army stirred in the afternoon and marched north along the river. March wasn't quite the word. There were no formations or drummers to the gathered clans, just a steady, long-legged stride, the product of long generations crossing the hills and plains on their own 2 feet. At times, Dante had to jog to keep up. At sundown, they stopped in the woods to eat and sleep. Whistles woke them while the sky was black and studded with stars. The march resumed within minutes. Dante's heart beat steadily and quickly, bringing him swiftly to alertness. The clans poured from the forest into the bare land surrounding Dolendon. The dark and sleeping city gave no sign it knew what was to come.
Chapter 22. Something was wrong. Smoke rose from the middle of the river. Orange flames reflected from the black waters.
"Oh, look," Blaze said. "The river's on fire again."
Dante gazed across the water to the western shore, but it was too dark to make out any movement.
"Some might consider that a sign."
"Of Auron's favor?"
Lyra's eyes flicked to his brooch.
"Or his disdain?"
Dante shook his head.
"Of people who don't want us to cross the bridge."
Blaze grinned at her.
"I think you take his faith more seriously than he does."
"It just looks that way because Auron doesn't care."
Damp grass squelched under Dante's feet. The night was cool, but far warmer than the last time they'd been this far upriver. Despite the retreat of the cold, the city was quieter, too.
"Men are the ones who keep trying to drag the gods down to earth. The gods don't give a damn what we do to ourselves."
"That's not how I was raised," Lyra said.
"That's because you're not from here."
"Neither are you," Blaze said.
"Well, I learned better."
The advanced troops jogged away from the thudding mass of marching warriors. Some paused at the tents and yurts flanking the city. Silhouettes of Norrin pointed to a 3-story tower of fresh blonde pine standing at the edge of the tents. The lead warriors sprinted up to it, ducking to avoid any fire, and found the door was unlocked. They disappeared inside. A bird's whistle sounded, halting the army mid-stride. Moments later, the warriors emerged from the tower, their postures upright and casual. They waved the army forth. Norrin citizens popped from the tents to watch them pass. Blaze beckoned a woman over to ask what was going on.
The same thing I told the others.
Let's pretend I haven't heard it because I'm not the others, Blaze said.
Then I would tell you, in a tone of increased annoyance, that the Red Shirts fled their post 3 hours ago. They retreated across the river. An hour after that, the bridges went up in flames.
Their scouts must have seen us, Dante said. Either that or those bridges insulted them for the last time.
How strange, Blaze said. For a moment, I imagined we just drove the king's armies from one of the largest cities in his empire.
Sounds like a tactical retreat. Lyra touched the handle of her sword. What do they care if we take the Norrin shore?
Dante suspected she was right, and the next few hours bore that out. Among all the round-windowed wooden cottages, the courthouses, pubs, and guard stations, they found no living humans, and few dead ones. Most of the bodies lay in the burnt places, bones and twisted limbs poking from entire blocks of blackened timbers. The Norrin they spoke to repeated the recalcitrant woman's story. The soldiers had pulled out just hours before the army's arrival, torching the bridges behind them. There had been neither explanation nor violence, just a swift and total withdrawal. The chiefs encamped at the road along the piers. Scores of scouts roamed the streets. Others struck north to find the nearest bridge. Despite the lack of any official announcement, a brief meeting of chiefs assembled in the public room of one of the pierside taverns.
"Did anyone anticipate this?" Hop said.
Old Walt shrugged his bony shoulders.
"Never figured the Red Shirts would run from a city just to get away from a bunch of, what do they call us, grass munchers?"
"Too dumb to build homes," said the braided woman.
"Shaggies," volunteered a man who wasn't much older than Morn, reminding Dante he hadn't heard anything from Morn since the prior night. He touched his loon.
"Duckies," Hop said. "Since you're ducking the question of where we go next."
"We'd have to find a bridge if we wanted to press the attack," Stan said.
"If," Dante said.
"That was one of the words I said."
"The biggest of them, I'd say. Why back down now?"
Stan tapped the stumps of his fingers against the table.
"Bloodthirsty, aren't you?"
"Not especially."
Dante jerked his head westward toward the river.
"I'm just not looking forward to waiting around to learn what's to come from the heartland."
"Crossing a river to attack a fortified city is a bad idea, unless the idea is to spend the next decades of your life watching your bones be slowly flushed down the river."
That was the end of discussion. Everyone was too tired from the two marches and anticlimactic fizzling of their battle nerves. In the morning, Blaze and Lyra were nowhere to be found. Dante reached Morn through the loon and learned the Nine Pines had been delayed and wouldn't reach Dullendon until the following day. There was a listlessness to the troops in the tents. Dante felt it too. He went down to the docks to think amidst the smell of clams and the sound of gentle waves against the rocks. A mile across the river, the western shores waited. He was still trying to plot out their next move, when Blaze thunked down the dock in a dead run and pulled up beside him, panting.
"Come on. Need your help in the north end of the city."
"Did you just run all that way?"
"I was going to fly, but I must have left my wings in my other pants."
Dante tapped his brooch. "You do know you could have used your loon."
"Yes, but then I wouldn't have been able to throw you in a sack and drag you along behind me if you said no."
Dante stood, knees cracking. "What's up, anyway?" Blaze ran his hand down his mouth.
"I found where Cora lives."
"Who?"
"Cora, Banning's granddaughter. From the painting, you heartless shriveled-up tuber."
"Oh." He jogged after Blaze, who'd already started back up the boards.
"Is she all right?" "I said I found her house, not her. Up all night searching."
Blaze looked it, too.
his blonde hair flat and greasy, his eyes red and puffy, filled with the haunted glaze of the sleepless